Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Ranks FC as Champions League takeaway for the second time this week on the channel. My name's Jack Collins and I'll be your host today, and joining me just south of the Thames, it's Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, we're close together at the moment. Oh, we still haven't managed to see each other, which is slightly annoying, but yeah, there we go. But yeah, good, mate. I mean, obviously another great night of Champions League. Different from the first night, but nevertheless, very entertaining. Some brilliant personal, individual displays to take in as well. And ultimately, the other English side, Aston Villa here, not had quite as much joy as Arsenal did on the last podcast we did.
Yeah, I mean, the German side struggling, I think, is probably something we can point
That's
to.
True. That's
the,
true.
The destruction of Borussia Dortmund. They lost 4-0 to Barcelona. Obviously, we talked about Bayern and their loss to Inter in the first Champions League takeaway. My big takeaway from yesterday's games, before we get into them individually, is that how joyful would a PSG-Barcelona final be at this point? I mean, partly the crash, right, in terms of how many young players would be on the pitch and young, exciting players as well. But I'm also wary of it because the last time that I got really excited about a fun, exciting, dynamic Champions League final was the potential Cruyff Classico in 2019, when Barcelona and Ajax looked set to play each other. That was an Ajax team who romped past Real Madrid, who dispatched Juventus, who were 1-0 up in the semi-finals against Tottenham, and then were obviously eliminated. And then also on the other side of it, you had Barcelona, who smashed Lyon, smashed Manchester United, and then obviously with 3-0 up against Liverpool before that incredible turnaround at Anfield. And that Cruyff Classico was denied to us. I don't want to get too excited about the possibility of Barcelona playing PSG in this final, because I know that Inter are going to have something to say about that at any stage because of the way that they play. But the neutrals final at this point, surely, has to be PSG against Barcelona. Not just the narrative arc of it, the whole Luis Enrique going back against his former club, but I just think in terms of the football that would be on display, we could be on for like a 4-3 Champions League final, one with completely breaks off. And that would be incredibly exciting. And the displays that both put in last night, truly incredible in many different ways. Should we start with PSG? They won 3-1 at home against Aston Villa, coming from behind, roaring back from behind, really. But even though Villa took the lead in this one, and there were some amazing scenes in the away end, and I imagine there were some incredibly loud scenes across England with Villa fans grouped. I know there was a lot of different pockets of Villa fans around the country who would have gone absolutely ballistic at that Morgan Rodgers goal, and a really well-worked goal it was. But also, just the way that they were kind of on the back foot from the moment go, I think speaks to just how much this PSG side believe in themselves right now.
It was really difficult for Unai Emery, I think, to know how to approach this game. And I think he kind of put his beliefs and ego almost to one side to just try and get through this match. If you consider what like Ange Postecoglou would have done in this match, right? And he'd have just been like, nope, I'm going to stick by my philosophies and I'm going to do this and this is how we're going to play. And if we lose, well, at least we lose playing the way that I believe in. And Emery doesn't really do that. And that's why, you know, Villa had a decent chance and have got this far in the tournament, because he knows what it takes to win knockout games. And he knows he had to stay in this tie. So, you know, not the most beautiful footballing setup from Aston Villa, but one that had a chance of working and one that was working reasonably well. And to be honest, until that injury time, stoppage time goal, it was a great result. Like losing 2-1 to PSG would have been a very good result. But Villa obviously have a bit of a habit of conceding stoppage time goals. I think they've conceded most in the Premier League. And that felt really painful. But it was so deserved. PSG, are just so much better than Aston Villa at the end of the day. And that was the job that Villa had in front of them. I think most of us knew that. I think we all expected that PSG go through from this tie, that Villa were going to have to come up with a great game plan and also execute it perfectly if they were to come out of it alive. And I'm not sure they have come out of it alive, to be honest. I mean, I can't personally see.
Alive, but not kicking is probably how I think.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, Unai Emery has said there's not a lot of difference between losing 2-1 or 3-1. I mean, that's not true. There's a lot of difference, isn't there?
Especially without away goals. Like, if there was away goals in it, then I think that probably matters slightly less. Because, you know, you can, yeah, can work it out when you're in that kind of category. Because if you've got the away goal, then fair enough. I think the problem is that, and I would say the same thing about the other game, but you can't see PSG not scoring, which means you have to kind of look at it and think, okay, well, Villa are going to have to score three. Now, there were chances, although they were relatively few and far between, and a lot of them fell to Morgan Rodgers and kind of maybe snapshots, half chances, etc. I thought that Villa did almost as well as they could have in the situation. And that's not to downplay Villa, who are an excellent side, who were on a 7-match winning streak coming into this one. I just think that you'd struggle to find many teams in world football who'd be able to deal with PSG when the kind of mood that they were in last night. And look, whilst Liverpool went to the Parc des Princes and they got a 1-0 win, we all came out of that one being like, how on earth have they got away with that, right? Yeah. And you need something spectacular, a Superman performance from Alisson in that regard, but also, you know, just things certainly not falling in the way that perhaps PSG expected in that first leg. And yesterday, I mean, the amount of chances created, and this is something that I would kind of point to. We talk about this PSG and this new era of PSG, right? And we discuss the fact that Luis Enrique has taken away the superstars, stopped the tail wagging the dog in many ways in terms of the way that the club operates. So it's not, you know, the biggest names on the pitch who are basically doing the talking. You know, it's only a couple of years ago that we were talking, perhaps, you know, erroneously, and I think it was blown out of proportion, about the fact that Kylian Mbappe was becoming sporting director of the club, right? And making big decisions in terms of what was happening on the pitch. And I think that the shift away from that has basically, it has been a wonderful thing from a PSG perspective, because they've been able to build a team that's more than the sum of its parts, it's cohesive, all of the above. But also, I think in the midst of that, there's been this kind of sense that Luis Enrique is now the star of this team, right? That he is the man who is the light, who has the limelight, who is basically making all the strategic decisions that see what this team does. But that doesn't mean, I think some people think that means the individuality has gone out of this team. And you watch last night's display and there is no way that that's the case. Mm. Yes, the midfield works better as a unit. Yes, the forward line now tracks back and helps with its defensive duties. And yes, there are the parts of the team that all work far more functionally as a whole. But if you're watching the displays from Kvara, from Désiré Doué, from Ousmane Dembélé last night, even Fabian Ruiz, who played one of the best passes I've ever seen off balance to let Kvara down the wing at one point, you're thinking, how have you done that? Leaning backwards when the ball was behind you on the spin. And there's some interchanges, I think, in the first half. And I think it's Hakimi and Dembélé on the edge of the box. It sets up a chance that Emi Martinez does really well to save. And it's just like the interchanges are so fast and so sort of cerebral, I suppose is the word. They're not even thinking about it. It's telepathic, the way that they're reading each other's movements, that it makes them almost impossible to stop, because not only now do they have the individual quality to dig them out. And look at all three of these goals, right? Like outstanding goals. The Doué one, the top corner finish is sublime. The turn that Kvara does and then fires it in at the near post, ridiculous. And then the chop back from Nuno Mendes in the 91st minute, to have the wherewithal to do that as a left back, to chop back, leave two players on the floor and lift it over to score the goal that might be the crucial one in the tie. Absolutely ridiculous in terms of what they're putting together. And I think that combination between the individual quality they have, the freedom that Luis Enrique gives us front three players to go and express themselves on the pitch and be able to shoot from distance and be able to make things happen and be able to trust each other to dovetail through positions and rotate into different wide areas and central areas so that they're incredibly hard to track, plus the fact that it works as part of a cohesive whole, is the most impressive part of this whole thing.
Yeah, I was thinking during the game how PSG had tried, looked into signing Marcus Rashford, right, to play on the left, and now they had Kvaratskhelia. I think they've done all right out of that, you know.
A decent decision, that.
I mean, I don't want to, like, this isn't like to batter Rashford, but Kvaratskhelia, when you see him like that, you're like, what? Like, that goal is just unbelievable. For a player that's cost, pounds, what was it, like £60 million? £60 million?
Yeah.
Something like that. Like, it's not even that much money in today's football money. So, and Rashford, you know, even if you were to buy him now, isn't like too far off of that sort of valuation. And obviously, was Rashford a good outlet in this game? Was he a good enough outlet in this game? I don't know. I've seen player ratings today. Like, some people are giving him 7 out of 10 and some are giving him 4.5 out of 10. Nobody really knows where it sits.
I don't think you can really pin any blame on him. It wasn't that they couldn't use the different elements of it, right? It wasn't that they couldn't use, that Rashford didn't do what he could with the ball. It was just there was no escape. It was suffocating from a PSG perspective, and it just kept coming. I think this is it, right? Like, look, Kvaratskhelia, I think Barney Rone in The Guardian called him the most watchable player in Europe right now. And I thought that was probably a fair point if you didn't have Rafinha playing in the Barcelona game, if you didn't have Lamine Yamal playing in the Barcelona game, you didn't have Désiré Doué doing what he was doing here. But the question was, you know, before the game, Sam was texting me, Sam's an Aston Villa fan, and he texted to say, Matty Cash against Kvara, this could be fun, with a kind of squiggly face. And within, 17 minutes, he's booked for his fourth foul, just trying to somehow stem the bleeding on that right-hand side as they took Aston Villa to town, down both flanks. And you kind of wonder, who is going to be able to stand up to this kind of punishment down both flanks? Because it's not you can focus your defensive effort on one side. Cash is obviously pulled at half-time because he's on a booking and because, well, he was going to be sent off if he continued down that in that kind of element. They bring on Axel Di Sassi. Before he's even touched the ball, Kvara has left him sitting on his bum, you know, with a cut inside, chopped backwards and fired PSG into a 2-1 lead. There is no answer to this kind of... No, 100%. But the point being that I don't know who is the answer to those problems. I don't know who stands up and goes, yeah, I can sit here and comfortably deal with Kvaratskhelia on one side, Désiré Doué floating out to that side as well to double up, Ousmane Dembélé down the other flank, Nuno Mendes flying onwards and you know, finding overlaps, Hakimi running down the other flank. How do you try and breach this? I mean, look, we might get an answer to this if Barcelona play Inter in the next round, because obviously Inzaghi will have some sort of defensive setup off the back of his 3-5-2 that will try and find solutions to these problems. But I'm struggling to see how anybody stops this, because there is so much attacking power going forward that it means that you don't even need, yes, obviously Villa score a brilliant goal and it comes from a great John McGinn tackle. And actually their best chances all came from John McGinn winning back the ball in midfield and launching them onto these counters. And that's not to say PSG are invincible. I don't think they are. I think there is an element here that they could be caught in terms of leaving themselves a little bit too exposed on the back. But I just can't see a team right now that's going to stop them scoring. And that's a scary prospect.
And they've all got a rest at the weekend.
Yeah.
They've cancelled their game. There's no game for PSG at the weekend. Their next game is Aston Villa. Like, that's huge. Like, so they've now got a rest. They're already winning 3-1. They're invincible. They're looking to become invincible in Liga this season. They haven't lost a game so far. These two teams are kind of worlds apart at the moment, and you're just hoping that, like we were talking about Real Madrid needing a kind of Bernabeu miracle, that the whole end can conjure up some sort of, you know, unworldly atmosphere and intimidate PSG, and that Villa score early and rattle them, and that PSG don't score.
Villa Park will be absolutely bouncing. I don't think it's going to matter.
I just don't think it will matter enough, because there's so much to overcome here, and to stop, to rattle that midfield enough so that they don't get a grip on the game and control it, and then also to stop that front three from scoring a goal at some point. It just seems to be too much of a stretch to me. Don't get me wrong, it's not impossible, but it's going to be difficult. I mean, how much Emi Martinez has helped things here? He's, I mean, obviously the ultimate wind-up merchant, but turning up in an Argentina hat, like having the Argentina colours in his hair, like I know it's all part of his personality and it's part of the fun.
I enjoyed it. And it's also, not, then he put the reason in, they lost, put in a pretty phenomenal performance. Without him, it could have been far, far worse.
I mean,
nothing you can do about those three goals, I don't think.
No, I mean, it's obviously the one just before they go 1-0 up too, which is like a mad moment. But I do wonder if he added to the motivation levels of this PSG team. Like, that's the only thing I would say. I know it, as I say, it's part of his personality. This is how he feels he gets the best out of himself to act like this. But I don't think it was that helpful on the day. Yeah, ultimately, look, Villa, we're always going to find this difficult. And I just think the fact that they had to sit so compact, they had to withstand all of this pressure. And I just didn't feel like they had a reliable outball or even perhaps a good enough plan with the outball to escape and then make the most of it. Their goal was brilliant. I like that they worked that perfectly. And obviously in that moment, you're like, whoa, there's something here. But to only hold onto the lead for 4 minutes, I know it's a bit speculative from Doué, but it's also pretty masterful. It's not an accident it's ended up in the top bin. Like he's worked for that moment. And for a lot of people, like in England and stuff, they won't really know much about Doué. You know, he's somebody that I've learned about because of the transfer market and my reporting around that. You would have seen him because you watch more Liga football. But for a lot of people watching this game, they wouldn't have actually known that much about him. And well, they certainly do now, because that goal would have woken them up. And just the overall performance, if you watch that game back, yeah, he's a special lad.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's been a lot made of the fact that Doué means gifted, right, in French. And it was a display of that. But I think it's probably testament to the fact and to his development over the course of the season here that he was given the nod. Now, a lot of people would have obviously seen his winning penalty against Liverpool, but probably hadn't necessarily kept track of him over the course of the season. There was talk that Tottenham were involved in trying to sign him last summer. There were a couple of English clubs, you know, interested in signing him. But I think that what we saw here was him giving the nod over Bradley Barcola. That's interesting, right? Because Barcola had such a brilliant start to this season, was flying in this PSG team. And over the course of the campaign, that's not to say that Barcola has fallen off because he's having a wonderful campaign of his own. But Zaradua, who started the season a little bit tentatively, and you saw in those kind of early Champions League games where he'd come off the bench and there was skill there and talent, obviously, but it wasn't quite sure how he fitted into the system. And the way that he's grown over the course of this campaign, the way that he has been stage managed by Luis Enrique to come to this point where he steps in here and he doesn't feel out of place with this superstar front line, right? He didn't feel at all out of place in the way that the three of them worked together and they interlinked is pretty stunning. And that, I think, is testament because he was brilliantly talented at Rennes, right? And I think that there was a lot of interest in what he did. But we're kind of seeing a player here who doesn't have too many negative aspects, who is still so young, obviously at 19 years old, and who is starting to really make his mark and nail down himself as a genuine bona fide starter in this team. Now, what that means for Barcola, who's only a couple of years older, I don't quite know yet. But I think that his emergence here and the fact that he is given the nod to start in a game of this magnitude and then puts in a performance like that, wow. Like, that is some way to announce yourself, isn't it? But he's just so confident on the ball. He's another one of those players that, you know, he fits naturally into this model because he does all the things that Kvara does and that Ousmane Dembele does. He can go both ways. He can shoot from distance. He can interlink in the box. And that's exactly what Luis Enrique is looking for in this front three. But he still puts in the hard yards as well. And that, I think, is the crucial element to all of this when you're kind of looking at it and seeing what PSG are and what they have become. It revolves around that mesh between the sublime individuality that is on show at certain players, but also this ability to buy into a team ethic that, you know, no one matters more than the badge. And that is the change we've seen under Luis Enrique and since the superstars, that Galactics era, has ended. You know, last year, people were laughing at Luis Enrique for saying, we're going to get better when Kylian Mbappe leaves. And people saying, well, he's the best player in the world. How on earth are you going to get better when he leaves? Mm. I mean, I think the evidence is in front of you.
Yeah, and it's also like that intensity that they played with. I mean, I talked in the Real Madrid game about a lack of intensity from Madrid that was missing and kind of hurt them. And PSG just are so busy. They're so busy. They're so energetic. And it was so apparent that the work rate of that team was going to match the individual talent. And the collective that they've built has been really impressive. Obviously, it helps when you're not losing a game all season. Like you're in a nice place. Doesn't matter whether you're playing five a side or whether you're playing Champions League. Like an unbeaten run breeds this relationship and bond between the players that is greater than anyone else is going to have. But they still are willing to put in the work rate, and they don't drop off. And I think, you know, when you take in the midfield particularly and the work rate of Jean Neves and what he gets alongside him in Vitinha, like if they are on it in terms of both, like, we're not giving the ball away today and we are going to work harder than you, you got no chance, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I mean, just a word for Villa, because I thought that they resisted quite well in the first half, right? They battled. I think there was a stat that at halftime, John McGinn had touched the ball 6 times and Vitinha had touched it 66. And that was probably a testament of how the game was going, considering both of them play in central midfield. But you know, they made a fight of this in the first half. Yes, Martinez came to the rescue a couple of times, just overwhelmed by the pure brilliance of PSG in the second. But there is grit, there is fight, there is definitely heart in this. And I thought that McGinn was probably the best player on the pitch from an Aston Villa perspective, in terms of the way that he just whirled around in the middle, you know, kind of constantly pressing, constantly trying to force an outlet. And yeah, obviously wins the turnover for the first goal. But it's going to take something more than just that desire and heart, I think, to turn this around. And that isn't to put down at Vence Villa. They've just come up against what seems like an irresistible force here in PSG. And, you know, this isn't an overturnable, insurmountable deficit. I think if they'd come out at 4-0 down, then there would have been no way back. I still think this is going to be incredibly difficult and it's going to require something pretty spectacular. But we know Unai Emery has done that in the past. So, you know, if you were going to offer, I think if you'd offered Villa fans a 2-1 loss before ball was kicked, a lot of them would have taken it. The third goal obviously takes a little bit of it's a bit of a hard to swallow one and takes the biscuit a little bit. But I think generally Villa did as well as they could under incredibly testing circumstances.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, look, the fans got their big moment. You know, they got us to celebrate, especially an opening goal. And then that's
Prince William going absolutely ballistic in the stands.
I loved how he's trying to get his George into it as well. You know, like he's trying to make sure that, like, he understands what limbs are at this early age. And yeah, it was good to see him going for it. I also liked his, like, when they interviewed him, you know, trying to give like proper, I don't know if you saw it, but
yeah, I've seen it. I'm very much no royalist, but I did think it was a good interview. I did think it was very funny. I don't know if you saw some of the backlash. People were like, get Rio Ferdinand off the telly and get this dude on his
It was just so funny how he actually spoke about pressing and stuff, you know, and he's like, actually, like, he has thoughts about this game tactically and how it's going to, like, you don't really expect that. And you don't normally get it from, like, particularly like royal figures to talk in detail about how they think Aston Villa could beat PSG. They would just like stick to the party line, say they're happy to be here and hope the lads do well. But he's so into it. Like, this is his team. And that those feelings he had were genuine, as all the fans in the way in, for sure.
Yeah, fair enough. Right, we're going to take a break there. When we come back, we'll be switching our focus to Barcelona's demolition job on Borussia Dortmund. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Ranks FC. Let's cross over to the fourth and final quarterfinal. Barcelona 4, Borussia Dortmund 0. It's done. There ain't going to be a miracle in the second leg of this one. The miracle might be that, I don't know, they score a goal or something. I mean, this is just not up for debate. There is no way that Barcelona are not already through to the semi-finals, is there?
No, there is no way that Barcelona are not through to the semi-finals. I'd love to give a controversial or antagonistic answer there, but unfortunately, I think this one is done and dusted. I'm feeling pretty smug, Dean. We did our MVPs chat the other week about who was going to be the difference makers in this. And a few of them were the under the radar ones. And I feel especially smug about this one because I said that Nico Schlotterbeck could be the absolute key here. And he then got injured at the weekend and is going to miss the rest of the season. Mm. And Dortmund capitulated defensively in this game. And I think that plays a massive part in it. You know, when you have Emre Can in your back line, and look, Emre Can has been a great servant for Dortmund, right? Like, I don't want to sit here and pour scorn upon him, because I think that what he's done at the club has been a little bit underrated in terms of what he's put in from kind of heart and soul perspective, but also the way he's bounced around positions and filled in gaps and done what was needed to do. But at the back here, he looked a little bit lost yesterday alongside Valdemar Anton. And I wondered how they were going to try and deal with that absence with Niklas Süle still recovering from a knock. At the same time, he came off the bench, but clearly wasn't, you know, trusted or fit enough to start. It wasn't a weird game. It played out exactly how I thought it was going to play out, in that Barcelona were just way too good, a whirling dervish of everything that you expected from them. All three of the front line on the score sheet, Lamine Yamal, two for Robert Lewandowski, who now has 29 goals in 28 games against Borussia Dortmund since leaving them. That is haunting of the highest caliber.
It's madness.
It's really tough. He's got way past the point where he doesn't celebrate goals against them. He's like, I can't do this. I've scored 29 times. I've got to celebrate these goals at this point. And Rafinha scoring as well. Although there's been some controversy about this. I don't know if you've seen this goal, Dean, but he slides in and taps home Pau Cabarsi's header.
Yeah, sir.
The Spanish press are going absolutely ballistic about it. I mean, I feel a bit for Rafinha here. Like, he's obviously just been like, let's get the ball in the back of there. It's the first goal.
You like, just got to make sure it's in. Like, who cares?
I think you probably leave it go.
That you don't leave that. There's no way.
I was like, yeah, I get it. That it would be Pau Cabarsi's first Champions League goal. And
he's like, sorry, mate. There's no room for sentiment here. We're playing. We've got to get this goal. I'm just getting that thing over that line. Like, that's all that matters in that moment. And if you think, that he's not going to do that because he wants... He's thinking in that moment about a narrative, then I'm not sure what planet you're on, really.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I feel for Rafinha here. People are like, he's greedy, he just wants the Ballon d'Or. I'm like, he's greedy because he's having the season of his life. And he's now scored as many goals in a single Champions League campaign as Lionel Messi has for Barcelona. And we're at the quarterfinals. I know there's two extra games in the group stage. Yeah, I get it. But... you know, this is a team who are working the same way. I don't think Pau Cabarsi is that upset about this. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I think that Pau Cabarsi is probably delighted that he's got a clean sheet and they've won 4-0 at home against Borussia Dortmund. They did give up chances, Barcelona. I will say this. You know, we talked about the fact that the high line potentially could be activated by a strong forward line or a quick forward line from Borussia Dortmund, Girassi, Adeyemi, and Jamie Gittins in this case. I thought it might be Maxi Bayer, but it was Gittins. And they did get in behind. They did force some openings. They forced some opportunities. Nothing hugely that Szczesny had to deal with that was out of the ordinary, but there were opportunities there. And I imagine teams will look at that and think, okay, there is a way to get a Barcelona, but just too good is the way that I would put it. And, you know, we talked at the start of the episode about the fact that, you know, you want to see this Barcelona team do well. People are going to want to see them progress because they play such incredibly easy to watch football. And look, I thought that Frankie de Jong and Pedri were absolutely sublime in the middle, keeping the ball moving, keeping everything ticking, and just being everywhere. Fermín López steps in for Dani Olmo in that position. I wasn't sure whether they were going to go Ferran, move Rafinha inside, but they went with Fermín López and I thought he was excellent. He should have probably scored at least one, maybe two. Some big opportunities fell his way that he didn't quite take, but his role in the 10 I thought was very, very sharp. And then, you know, you get to the front three who were just ridiculous again. The way that they spread the ball between them, the interchanges, you know, we talk about that PSG front line. Well, here's another one that can set your heart on fire very, very quickly. And you know, the way that they interchange for a couple of these goals, you know, the dinks into the box, the head back across from Rafinha, the tap in from Lewandowski, the way that Lamine Yamal is released for his fourth goal, and the finish on this, the nonchalance of sort of that first time flick it round the keeper with the outside of your foot finish to a fourth goal in a Champions League game like this. Ridiculous. But I don't know. They just feel at the moment irrepressible, still unbeaten in 2025. And look, one of the things that I kind of noted was the amount of stats that came off the back of this, the amount of records. You know, we're talking about Mo Salah earlier in the season. You're like, it feels like every game there's like 15 different records broken. Well, Barcelona last night. So they're the only team in Europe's top five leagues yet to lose in 25. And they're enjoying a 23 game unbeaten run across all competitions. It's the best unbeaten start in a single year of their history. 119, drawn 4. That Robert Lewandowski stat about him scoring 29 in 28. He's also scored more goals against Borussia Dortmund than any other club since leaving them in 2014. He became the first player to score for three different teams in 10 goals in a single season in Champions League history: Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich, Barcelona. He's the first player in Europe's top five leagues to score 40 goals in all competitions this season. Then you go to Rafinha. Rafinha, the first player in Champions League history to record more than 10 goals and more than 5 assists in a single campaign. He's been directly involved in 19 Champions League goals this season: 12 goals, 7 assists, joint most ever with Lionel Messi. Also joined Messi in becoming the second Barcelona ever to score 12 goals in a single edition of the competition. Less than 3 years ago, Dean, Rafinha was celebrating with the Leeds fans at Brentford, avoiding relegation, and now he's the bookies' favourite for the Ballon d'Or. Like, this is the turnaround we've seen in this one. Pau Cabarsi became the youngest defender in Champions League history to provide an assist, even if it wasn't an assist on purpose. He surpassed Vincent Kompany from October 2004 with Anderlecht. Lamine Yamal became the youngest ever player to reach 20 Champions League appearances, 17 years and 270 days old. Also the youngest player to score in back-to-back games in the competition. Like, wow. They are reeling off stats at this point. Every single game seems to bring more. And, you know, I was looking this up to write some scripts for this morning and for various podcasts. So I was reading all these stats. And I was struck by the fact that in almost every other game, even the Real Madrid loss, which, you know, was a pretty brutal loss, there was a stat about Real Madrid. There was nothing about Borussia Dortmund. It was just Barcelona, 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 Barcelona. And I appreciate that that is partly because of the nature of the football world and that, you know, the biggest clubs get the most headlines, et cetera, fine. But it struck me that this was so one-sided in that regard that, but the fact that was that Borussia Dortmund were kind of a side note, they were a footnote to what happened in this game. And that is a deeply dark place to be. Even the yellow wall, I don't think, can turn this one around.
No, I've got a stat. The last team to score 4 goals against them was Holstein Kiel. So it just shows that it can happen on any day. One thing that Barcelona don't want to talk about, mate, is the treble. But we should probably mention it here because Lamine Yamal's happy to talk about it. So am I. So it's kind of off limits. On social media, you won't see like your diehard Barcelona fans getting caught up in this. Hansi Flick doesn't want to talk about it. Lamine Yamal, he said, "I am one of those who always trusts their team. And since the beginning of the season, I've aspired to win everything. We could win the treble. You have to believe in yourself because if you say another team is going to win, why would you even go on the field? So yeah, we can win the treble. We're Barcelona. We've achieved it before. We'll go for it again."
Quad, they won the Supercopa, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, people aren't talking about that. This is your Champions League, your domestic cup, and the league title. Like those three competitions, Barcelona top of La Liga right now. They've got a cup final date with Real Madrid, and they've got one foot into the semi-finals of the Champions League. I mean, it really could. I mean, the two domestic ones, I'd say are pretty likely.
I think La Liga at this point looks likely. In a single game, in a cup final, a neutral ground against Real Madrid, I think Barcelona probably have the edge, but I'd say it's 55-45, maybe 60-40 at a push. But, you know, you kind of come to these moments and you think, well, when they're in this kind of mood, it's very hard to see teams stopping them. And then look, we come to that again. I'm beset by this thing about Inter, who I think might just be the most complete team left in the competition. in terms of what they can do from a defensive perspective. And, you know, I always go back to that. I was talking with Charlie Stilettano yesterday, and he basically said, you know, it was the old Sir Alex Ferguson quote, wasn't it? That strikers win you games, defences win you titles. And look, this Barcelona defence is brilliant, and they kept another clean sheet yesterday, but they play a risky game, right? So there is that element of risk that is associated with them. And I think that what we've seen this year is that this Barcelona side are going to, they feel that they can outscore you, right? There's that directness about them. And I spoke about this in depth on a Patreon episode a couple of weeks back, where I kind of took a little bit of a deep dive into where Barcelona were going and how the direction had changed under Hansi Flick. But it was kind of looking at that kind of directness and that confidence that they have to lose the ball high up the pitch, because they, one, fancy themselves in a defensive battle that they'll be able to catch players offside. But two, even if they do concede, they're like, it's all right, we'll score. And I think that that's a similar vibe to what PSG have at the moment. Mm. And that's why I think that's the neutrals final that people are going to want, because I think that you're looking at that and thinking that could be exciting. But I just have a sneaky feeling we're not going to get it. And I don't know where that is. And I don't know how it pans out, because, you know, you come with these grand ideas of what this game could be and, you know, how amazing it could look if these two were to meet in the final, these two forces of attacking nature. And you're kind of like, oh, could we get it? Could we get this kind of utopian dream of what it might be in a Champions League final? I hope so too. And not from any disrespect towards any other side in this competition. I just have a funny feeling that it's going to come crashing down like it did in 2019, that something is going to happen that stopped this becoming a reality. So, but I mean, look, just to kind of come back to the game, it's astonishing how quickly Barcelona move the ball when they want to get on the front foot, and the spaces that open up in front of both Rafinha and Lamine Yamal here to go one-on-one with their defenders, and the work that the midfield do in order to occupy central areas. There's a great article on The Athletic this week about the way that Robert Lewandowski is touching the ball far less than he ever has across the course of his career, but he's basically pointing at space, and the way that he is directing traffic. We used to talk about Jorginho in this way, right? Mm. He used to stand there and basically point about where the ball should be going. Mm. Well, Lewandowski's doing this for Barcelona from a different perspective, from a different angle. He's at the front, back to goal, basically showing everyone else where they should play. Yes. And he's only having to watch the game from one angle because he barely ever has to turn around.
Yeah.
And it's intriguing to see the different ways in which different managers do this. That kind of dovetailing, free-flowing attacking setup the PSG have is very different to this Barcelona team. They have the same independence, the same kind of freedom to go and show their individuality, I think, this front three, but they're quite stuck to where they play. Yes, Rafinha drifts into the middle a little bit and it allows Alex Balde to fly down that left-hand side. But on the whole, you know, Lamine Yamal holds his width on the right-hand side. Lamine Yamal will kind of wait there and wait for the ball to be sprayed over to him. And what that does is it allows him to go one-on-one with defenders, and then he wins. He either beats them and scores or sets something up, or he wins free kicks in dangerous areas. And that is, you know, where they score their first goal from, comes from a free kick. It's not Lamine Yamal that wins it. It's Jules Koundé on that side. But the point stands in terms of the switch of play. Weird free kick, by the way. Ever seen one given for hair pulling before from that kind of angle? Like, very strange. But I think the way that they play is different to what Luis Enrique is trying to do at PSG, but there is still that excitement with them going one-on-one and getting these players into those positions and those situations where they're able to stand up a defender and take them on. And, you know, in an era, you know, to go more general, in an era where we're talking a lot and people are talking a lot about the fact that football has become more robotic and system-based, and we heard Gary Neville talking about this after the Manchester Derby at the weekend, these two sides, Barcelona and PSG, feel like a real breath of fresh air in terms of what they're allowed to do, but the individuality that they're allowed to express in these forward lines as well, that there are these players going one-on-one and allowing themselves to take on a player, to not worry about losing the ball because they have that faith in the rest of the team that either they're going to win it back or that they'll get another opportunity and they'll go again. And that, I think, is a nice antidote to some of the chat that we're seeing, that the best teams are now so coached, so rigidly structured, that that's not really what's happening here. Because for my money, the best two teams in Europe right now are PSG and Barcelona. Most complete team might be Inter, who are rigid, but also still have that freedom to express themselves in a very different way under Inzaghi. The best two teams, the best two teams to watch in Europe right now are PSG and Barcelona. And they are very much not wedded to that stereotype, not wedded to that thing. Yes, the systems work. Yes, there is a manager in complete control of both of them. And yes, there are elements of that team that have to work in a very structured, organized way. You look at that Barcelona high line, for example, in order for everything to work. But you're not losing out on the individual quality and the individuality of these wonderful players who are able to go and show what they are capable of every, and on any given day and any given match day.
Yeah, well, both teams have become fearless, and I think that they've kind of really appreciated like not having the expectations that they would have had in the past when all these big players were there, or even when Barcelona didn't have the big players. Because of the fall down that they had, you didn't expect them to be in this situation where even thinking about a treble at this point in the season. And so I think that they're all enjoying the fact that they were able to surprise people. In the past, that wasn't the case because they had such high expectations to meet. And now the two teams that had Messi are striving for greatness without him. And that's a good place for us all to be, to see these both these teams recover, not rely on that player or even somebody that's a version of him, an Mbappe or a Neymar or whatever. The way they are relying on it is by finding the new talent, by getting your Lamine Yamals and your Kvaratskhelias, and these are the guys of the next generation that we're going to start to embrace and start to talk about. That's what I love. Like, we've got the new stars coming here, and that's why you want these two sides to meet as well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, do we finish with Lamine Yamal? 17 years old, and now the youngest player to make 20 appearances in the Champions League. Have you seen a player like this at 17 since Kylian Mbappe broke through at Monaco, perhaps?
It doesn't happen very often, obviously, but, you know, whether you're Messi or Mbappe, I mean, Wayne Rooney had like a, wasn't the same type of player, but he had an incredible impact from day one. And again, they're all like undeniable talent, completely fearless, don't care about what is in front of them. And like, it's just something that they're just born that way. It's like they're born that way. It's just expected of them from other people, but also just from themselves. And there's nothing you can do to stop it apart from injury. You obviously, we hope with Lamina that his early arrival on the scene doesn't impact on how many years we get to see of him, because it's just outrageous that he can be this good this often. If you think back to like Ansu Fati, right? Breakthrough. 100%. Like, was never convinced like wholly that he would hang around, and I don't think like really was expected to have this kind of impact, but when you have your big rise, you've got to stay there. And a lot of players do find it hard, and understandably so. Like, you're playing with men, established professionals. You've got to hold yourself in an environment where you don't really belong yet. Like, you don't belong in a man's world yet because you're a kid. Like, genuinely, you're a child at 17 still. You might feel like you're an adult, but you're not. You're still growing, like literally still growing.
Yeah.
And to hold yourself in the way that Lamine does, it's hard to even understand how you can do it, to be honest. It really is.
With Ansu Fati, it felt like they were grasping at someone to fill the gap, right? And yeah, they fast-tracked him way too quickly, the number 10 shirt, all of that. And it just felt like everything was super rushed. And then it didn't feel comfortable at all, right? In terms of that drop off, and the injuries obviously didn't help whatsoever. I still think Ansu Fati was a wonderful player when he broke through, but there wasn't this kind of element of excitement around him in the same way. I think that Barcelona were desperate for anything to be like, oh, we're going to build a new star. We're going to find one in the academy. And it was all just way too fast tracked. With Lamine, it's felt very natural, I think, in terms of the way that he has gone about it. And look, he's obviously moved through the shirt numbers. He's now 19. He's now wearing the 19 that Messi wore for a couple of years. I wonder when. It's a question of when, not if, he gets that Barcelona number 10 shirt. But I would quite like them to hold it for one more year. I think I would like them to hold him onto that 19 shirt one, but I think the fast track will come this summer. I think we've got to the point now where so many kids. You see it at the stadium, right? And they were panning around it earlier. There are so many people in Lamine Yamal 19 shirts at this point that I think Barcelona are going to be like, we're going to have to, just from a commercial perspective,
making
the number 10 at this point.
But it's going to be the biggest shirt in football, isn't it? I mean, it already is like seen everywhere. Like around here, like I've obviously been, I love to pay attention to what shirts kids are wearing. And when I take Dylan down to Walton and Hersham, where all the kids like play on the Astros and stuff, and like I'm looking at the kits, and obviously you've still got the local teams like Chelsea's and Fulham's and Arsenal's and stuff like that. But outside of that, it's Lamine Yamal Barcelona kits. They're everywhere. A couple. I saw the other day, I counted, there was out there, I don't know how many kids were on the out there playing, say 60, 70 kids all playing in different parts. There was two kids with Pedri shirts on at Barcelona.
Absolutely. Those two are making it. You know, put them right now. Those kids are absolutely tapped in already.
And there was like, I think it was six who had Lamine Yamal shirts on. And I was like, that's quite a high percentage of kids in this small English town to have on shirt of a kid who's 17. Like, some of the kids were like 14 themselves. So, yeah, it's crazy. There was a story yesterday that went around. I mean, it was from a Spanish site I don't trust ever, which is called Fecheus. Manchester City would be willing to spend 275 million euros on Lamine Yamal if Barcelona were willing to do a deal this summer. Can you
imagine the uproar if Barcelona sold Lamine Yamal?
Should we do a deal for him? What do you reckon? Should we take the money?
What's his release clause? Has he got one of those $1 billion release clauses?
I think he might, yeah. I think
they'd be like, no, pay up or nothing.
Like, should we take the near 300 mil, or should we keep him for 20 years? Keep him for 20 years. That's what you do.
Yeah, 100%. Hey, man, maybe it's a financial lever. We'll never know. I think it's probably time on that note to wrap things up on today's Champions League takeaways. All there's left for me to say thank you very, very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever. The truth will be back tomorrow where Doogie and Sam and I are talking about Chelsea and the fall off in 2025. Seeing what's happened under Enzo Maresca and why the wheels have come off at Stamford Bridge. So make sure you're tuned in for that one. But for now, and from us, until next week, we will see you very shortly, Rank Squad. Thanks for listening. Take it easy. Peace.